bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection for the special session of the 74th Legislature. I'd like to start out perhaps by having an introduction of our committee members. We have a new committee member on this dais today, and it's Representative Springer, and we want to extend our welcome to you. Hope you enjoy the topics, and it's been a pretty lively committee, and we usually try to get some good work done and in a respectful way from
so
most.
It's been lively on that end.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I thought you might want to move Representative Gillum down here in place of Representative Riley, because Representative Springer is a former cop. And it might be the first time that he is, you know, checked.
I could never replace Representative Riley.
So anyway, with that, Representative Springer, would you just identify your district, and then we'll just move down the line and let everybody get a chance to introduce themselves and tell us what district you serve?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I serve House District 17. That's up the canyon, Scio, Lebanon area.
I'm Chuck Riley. I'm the heart of Washington County, District 29, Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove.
And I'm State Representative Donna Nelson, whose territory includes Jam Hill County and a portion of Polk County, retired Senior Vice President of Evergreen International Aviation and all its subsidiaries, and spent most of my life in 178 countries, and it sure makes you realize you know, our blessings. And I ran for the legislature after my retirement from Evergreen and putting together Spruce Goose Museum because I had a great concern for the people. And my mantra was that it's the well-being of the people that matter most. And I'm delighted to work with such a fine chairman and co-chairman and committee members. And I'm so very, very proud of the many things that have been accomplished because of this committee. It's a long time coming, and it's like support for the veterans. It's our job to look after our people, and I thank you for letting me be a part of it.
Thank you for those kind words, Representative. I'm Representative Paul Holvey from Eugene, Oregon, District 8. It takes in Vanita, Lorraine, Crow, Alma, and the University of Oregon, downtown Eugene, and the South Hills as we know them.
I'm Representative Suzanne Bonamici. My district is House District 34. And if Representative Riley's is the heart of Washington County, mine is the, I'm trying to figure it out.
Be careful.
Shoulder. I represent the northeast corner of Washington County. There's a company called Nike right in the middle of my district.
All right. And I might add that our administrator might like to show his shoes. Show your shoes. He's got, okay, oh. Brand new Nike shoes he designed himself.
That's a record show.
All right. That's very appropriate.
Next time you need to ask for permission.
Yeah.
To
do this.
Me or him.
Visual aid.
Visual aid.
I forgot. What am I supposed to do? Larry Galizio, House District 35, which is Tigard, unincorporated Washington County in southwest Portland.
And I'm Vic Gilliam from House District 18, Malala, Silverton, Oregon's Christmas Tree District, and I have visited Washington County.
You have what?
Visited Washington County.
Wow. And I do have a request, Mr. Chair, that at some point during the committee hearing today, I would like to hear Representative Gilliam make a remark in a Spanish hillbilly dialect, which he has publicly advertised his ability to perform. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm so sorry.
Okay, now that we've got all those antics out of our system, we will move on with the organizational part of this meeting, in which we have some rules that are before us that have been adopted by the Committee on Elections and Rules for all the committees of this body. And so with that, I'd like to open a work session for the organizational meeting for the purpose of adopting the committee rules.
Is that a motion?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the House Committee on Consumer Protection draft committee rules drafted February 4th, 2008.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici moves the adoption of the committee rules. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, it is with great sadness that I cannot vote for these rules for our House Committee on Consumer Protection. With reference to Part 13, where I feel that those of us who are in a minority position have been denied a quick way in which to get the points of our constituents heard has been denied us, as well as we've been denied the right to introduce a bill. I'm extremely saddened in that I felt that this would never happen in this legislature, and for that reason I cannot vote to deprive a portion of our people the right to be heard.
Further discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard this issue yesterday, so I will not belabor it other than to say I, too, can't vote for that. The rules for our committee based on that, number 13, I believe, the representative just pointed out. To me, a petition of 31 by any other name is a majority report. So for that reason and that reason alone, I will be voting no, but I don't intend to hold up our proceedings any further.
Thank you for that. I appreciate your comments, and the minority report is an important piece of our legislative process. I agree. However, in this special session, it still the minority report is available. However, it does have some limitations on it. But in past special sessions, I believe since 2001 or 2002, special sessions have not had any minority reports allowed. So although I know exactly what you're getting to with expressing the minority's position through a minority report, that is still possible if by following the procedures laid out in 13. I just would like to show up for the record that special sessions historically many times have not had minority reports at all in the interest of getting through a special session in a timely manner.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, with all of my greatest respect and appreciation for you, I would like to point out that never before, in my 8 years of being here, have we ever been denied the right to have a minority report other than the one-day session that we had. And that is my understanding. They were allowed. We may not have, needed them or used them at that time, but until this very session, they have always been allowed.
Well, I guess we'll have to check the record on that. But needless to say, I think your point has been taken, and I acknowledge the objections to the rule on the minority reports. However, having had this debate on the floor and having passed this and on the floor and also passed in elections and rules for all committees, I would like to go ahead and move on the motion and ask for a roll call vote on adoption of the committee rules.
Aye.
Aye.
Gilliam?
No.
Nelson?
No.
Aye.
No.
Aye. The adoption of the rules, having received the required votes, is declared adopted. Committee rules for the House Consumer Protection Committee. With that business out of the way, we will move on. Today we're focusing on House Bill 3631. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3631. And I neglected to introduce our committee assistant and my committee administrator here to my left, and Susan over there managing the sound and documentation of all events that happen here, and Jim Stembridge, an able person at my left here to assist me. And
very hopeful about that, aren't you?
And getting through this committee for the special session. I'm sure you'll do well.
Yes, I'm Jim Stembridge. Let me just mention committee administration background. Our office is in room 453. I can be contacted through the email system at jim.stembridge@state.or.us. Stembridge is Stembridge. Our phone number is 503-986-1745. And would you like me to go ahead with?
At this point, I'd like to have you give us a brief summary of House Bill 3631.
Chair Holby and members of the committee, House Bill 3631 prohibits retailers from selling, offering for sale, or otherwise distributing children's products that have been recalled in cooperation with the Consumer Product Safety Commission or subject to a warning either by the product manufacturer or another federal or state agency. It makes the violation a violation of the Unfair Trade Practices Act, the UTPA, and it declares an emergency taking effect upon passage. There is a provision that puts the prohibitions into operation on May 1st, 2008.
Thank you. And with that, I would like to open this up and start out by calling up somebody to go over the bill with us. And I believe I'm going to call up the Department of Justice, Andrew Scholl, to walk us through what this bill does, if you would be so kind.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee, Andrew Scholl, Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud, Consumer Protection Section. This bill looks at recalled goods, specifically those that have been recalled by the federal government or manufacturers. There is all kinds of law that talks about the actual recall and when manufacturers are either requested to voluntarily recall or there are also authority for mandatory recalls. But one of the what we and others have termed as a loophole is that with the item recalled, there isn't necessarily any authority for an enforcement action against retailers who continue to sell that recalled good. This one, this bill that's being proposed is narrowed in scope in the sense that what the concern is of the committee is injury or likely injury to children. So this has been limited to children's products, those children's products that are recalled voluntarily or otherwise by the United States Consumer Product Safety Commission or state agencies, notably DHS. The enforcement mechanism in the bill, should a retailer sell a recalled good that fits into the definition of children's product as set forth by the bill, is ORS 646-608. This is a provision in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act that allows for attorney general and district attorney actions through both assurances of voluntary compliance and through enforcement actions filed as civil lawsuits in the appropriate circuit court. It also provides for a private right of action where a consumer can show an ascertainable loss and show that it was a willful violation. With that, I'll open it up for questions, which I know there are several.
Thank you, Andrew. I want to start out with just going over the, you know, the basic principles behind this bill. Essentially, correct me if I'm wrong, but currently we have a recall product list from the federal government that issues, and it's a voluntary program, but there are no requirements that prohibit a retailer from selling that same recalled product. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, generally, that's the underlying problem. In egregious cases, there could be authority under general provisions of law, including possibly the UTPA, but that's not clear, and it's never been tested.
So, and I'm going to follow up with my own question. So, you know, I've heard, you know, stories in the news, on TV, you know, where reporters have gone out, and I've actually had, you know, some people contact me about this, about recalled products being on the shelf and people buying them. And wondering, you know, why is this allowed? You know, in this day of age, everybody assumes that once a product's recalled that they're taken off the shelf. And many times, you know, they are, quite frankly. And many retailers do, you know, check it at the counter, and they have a list they compare it to and are able to do that. But there is a concern out there for small retailers and how this bill would affect them. How do they know that a product's been recalled?
Chair Holvey, there are a couple of items. This bill primarily concentrates on the United States Consumer Safety Product Commission. Those are available on the website for the CSPC. Those are also available in an email form, and any person, and in fact we've had conversations with staff at the commission, is encouraged to sign up for those emails. I have now signed up. I received those emails. They are pretty regular. I understand some folks have voiced concerns of mom and pop operations that don't have access to the web or don't have email. There is also a toll-free number, as we understand. I have not called it yet. As we understand, there's also a toll-free number available to all who can contact the commission and receive those recalls. As for the limited number of items that may be prohibited from marketing in Oregon under DHS's authority, I don't know off the top of my head what those items are or where they're available. I believe some are actually statutory or actually written in the rule. So again, those would be available on the web or by contacting DHS.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Galizio.
Mr. Shull, could you talk a little bit about the private right of action remedy, why that's necessary?
Absolutely. Chair Holvey, Representative Galizio. As a general rule, in most cases where we are looking at any item from a financial fraud or consumer protection standpoint, we at the staff level believe that a private right of action, generally speaking, should be included. People deserve their day in court if, in fact, it has been made as a policy decision of this legislature to call whatever that item may be, a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Because as policy and as mandated by resources and everything else, the Attorney General, one, can't act as a private attorney for a private consumer. So in those instances where you do have a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, but you only have one consumer victim, it's problematic unless there's more, unless there's a pattern, unless there's widespread threat to many or most Oregonians, for the Attorney General to step in and take that action. And we believe that in this context, where what we're discussing is products that have been recalled or that have warnings on them because they have the propensity to cause injury to children or worse, sort of exemplifies the nature and the justification of a private right of action. Should a violation by a retailer cause harm to someone's child, they should be allowed to enforce the statute themselves.
Further questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Scholl, you mentioned that for a private right of action, the plaintiff would have to show that the violation was willful. Can you please talk about what it takes to show a willful violation?
Absolutely. There's a provision in the Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici. There's a provision in the proposed bill, which I understand is causing some concern, and it's Section 4, and it is in any action to enforce Section 2 of this 2008 Act, the retailer is presumed to have actual or constructive knowledge of recall notices and warnings issued by the United States Consumer Product Safety Commission and warnings issued by the actual manufacturer from which the retailer receives children's products. This is obviously a presumption, and it sets forth a knowledge basis within the statute. But also contained within the Unlawful Trade Practices Act is a willful standard. Particularly under the private right of action, there has to be shown a willful violation of whatever the provision is under 608 that the private litigant is pursuing. The willful standard under the UCPA is a defined standard, and it is knew or should have known. So it's essentially negligent.
Can I ask a
follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on that just a little bit. Could you talk about the difference that a plaintiff would face in bringing an unlawful trade practices claim just under the willful test that's knew or should have known versus the presumption that's in Section 4? And what would the differences be?
Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, immediately I would say the difference is under Section 4, it's a presumption. Therefore, it would be the defendant who is overcoming that presumption. They're overcoming the constructive or actual knowledge. Under a private litigant suit pursuant to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, it would be the plaintiff who has to show the willfulness. They would have to plead and show that essentially the defendant knew or should have known that they were violating this proposed act.
Okay, and one more follow-up. My question is that a difficult burden to prove that somebody knew or should have known under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act?
Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, it is a burden to be proved. Whether it's difficult or not, I think, is who you speak to. What it is simply essentially a negligence level. It's just above negligence. So in terms of comparing negligence to an intentional crime, it is not as difficult.
Thank you.
Representative Galizio, you had a quick follow-up on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't get a chance on the second. So going back, still staying with the same general issue, when you talked about the need for a private right of action because the Attorney General would probably only look at cases where there was a certain number, what is there certain criteria that the Attorney General uses in terms of deciding when to take action, or is it just a subjective decision?
Chair Holvey, Representative Galizio, it's obviously at the discretion of the Attorney General and the Attorney General's highest staff, but there are criteria under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act in particular. We may look at all kinds of things, including how many consumers have been harmed, what sort of threat exists for consumers, and to how many consumers in the future if the conduct isn't addressed. Obviously, we take into consideration past conduct. And there is also a fairly thorough review of other actions. You may have somebody who is clearly violating the UTPA, but it's already being addressed either by other state or federal agencies or by private litigants in court. Class actions are a good example of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So to be fair, Andrew, I sort of hear what you're saying in some regards, that the Attorney General's office may not pursue every case that comes to their attention.
Chair Holvey, the Attorney General, it's simply not practical for us to pursue every matter that's brought to our attention that may evidence some violation of law under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act or the likelihood of a violation of law. I mean, it simply does not happen.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shaw, could you please explain to me what does a small retailer do with returned goods? What has happened now in the past is that goods that have been defective have been found long after the sale. So immediately then, people want to, you know, bring it back. Do they have a responsibility now to take those back?
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, and I might need some clarification on that. Are these the folks who have already purchased them, or are they still retailers?
The retailer sold them. The purchaser, you know, a year later, hears on the news that this is a defective, you know, toy. Does the retailer have the responsibility to take those back?
Representative Hall, or Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, the short answer that to that is I don't know, because under the most recent recall that I reviewed from the Consumer Safety Products Commission, it set forth the appropriate information and mandates on what was to be done with the product, and it involved the manufacturer. I can tell you that I don't see anything in this proposed bill that would put a duty on a retailer to take that item back if it was sold prior to the recall.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So, really, there is no punishment for someone who sells products with lead, mercury, easily swallowed objects. There really is no punishment in our law for their doing that.
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, yeah, I mean, I generally speaking, I would agree with that statement. The reason we're looking at this bill is currently for a retailer to sell a recalled good in and of itself, you know, no other facts are present. The item was recalled last week, and for whatever reason, the retailer sold that good 7 days later. Enforcement authority and punishment for the sale of that good is few and far between, if it exists at all.
Okay, one last question, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
Thank you very much for being here and for all you do for the consumer. Mr. Shaw, I do a lot of auctions, so a lot of individuals, when a product is obsolete or is no longer the end thing, lots of toys, somebody wants to give you all of this, and there's a part of those products that can be used to make radios, the batteries for something else. Is that against the law here? I looked through this bill. I didn't see that anywhere.
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, when talking about that, there are some things that the answer depends upon. I think Representative Galizio at the last hearing brought up the fact of you just as an individual selling an item on eBay that has been recalled. Under this law, that wouldn't be a violation because it's not your vocation to sell things on eBay. So as I understand your question, if somebody's just providing you a box of stuff and that's not their vocation to provide you a box of stuff, then that in itself wouldn't be a violation. If you then operate a store, if that's your vocation, you could, of course, be violating the proposed bill if you go forward.
Even if I sell it as junk?
Even if you sell it as junk, arguably, yes.
So there's no protection? No punishment nor protection?
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, again, since this bill has been narrowed to children's products, if you're in the vocation, we would hope, and anecdotally, as I understand, most retailers make efforts and sometimes valiant efforts to make sure whatever their business is, selling junk or selling brand new Nikes, to make sure that they're not selling recalled goods.
Further questions of Mr. Scholl? Oh, Representative, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're just used to me being on that other side.
Yes.
And I appreciate you recognizing me. Thank you, Mr. Scholl, for being here. I want to get to a context for Oregon on this bill, and we don't have a member of the Consumer Product Safety Commission or their staff here, so you interface with them, and so I'm wondering if you'd answer a couple of questions to the best of your knowledge about these numbers.
To the best of my knowledge.
When I look at the background that was provided for us, I hope you have this in front of you as well. Maybe you don't. Jim's got his Nikes on, and you should have them shortly.
Should be a little faster, don't you think?
I think you should.
With those kind of shoes on.
However, Representative Gilliam, I believe he's here to address the bill and not specifically background, but I'll let you go further with your questioning for now.
More than I could have hoped for, Mr. Chair. CPSC has issued over 4,000, you see where I am on background, 4,000 product recalls and recallers. I'm wondering in what period of time that is. Is that in the history of their organization? And I'll just give you a couple of other ideas here that you might want to respond to. So it says 34 product recalls in 2008, 16 had to do with, and then it goes through the different things. Do we know, you had made some reference to this, do we know how many of those were in Oregon? If they were reported at all, how many of those products were sold in Oregon, how many kids it was reported that they were injured by these products, or how many cases there were relating to these. I notice 16, am I reading this right? 16 had to do with, and then it lists several toys.
15 years.
I guess 16 total among those toys.
Chair Hall, the Representative Gilliam, the short answer is no. I do not know how many of those were also present in Oregon, sold, and injured goods, or injured children.
Do you think, may I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
What about the 4,000? Do you know about the 4,000 number? Is that in the history of the commission? That surprised me, but I don't know if it is or not.
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, that could be dating back to, I believe they have records on their website dating back to 1976, and I'm looking for the number in my stuff, which is the last annual number I heard, and here it is. The CPSC reports to us that they have approximately 375 recalls per year.
So that's...
So the 4,000 may in fact be referencing either all time or back to the 1976 that's actually available on their website. That's probably a number that I can certainly check out for you and find out.
I'd be very interested in that because of how this boils down to what we're facing in the state of Oregon, I think is relevant. And one more, if you'd allow, Mr. Chair.
Well, on your first question, I wonder if Mr. Stembridge has any information, since he had something to do with the background that you're questioning Mr. Scholl about, and maybe we can have our committee administrator
great.
Yes, sir. Attempt to answer your question. I also have a note here that there was over 20 products this year so far in January, and over 100 last year. So.
Representative Gilliam, Mr. Chairman, yes, the committee administrators ordinarily do some research on these issues, and in checking out the Consumer Product Safety Commission's website, they did say that there had been over 4,000 recalls in the lifetime of that agency. I did hand you a list of the recalls that they are showing on their website for January, which amount to, I think, the 40 that were mentioned in the staff measure summary.
National.
That summary we provide to the members. Anyone who wishes to have a copy of it, we can get copies for you.
Mr. Chair, I notice the Tic Tac Turtle toss mats that you gave each one of the committee members at Christmas for your mention. And that is legal under ethics law, but you may want to be aware of the danger to
your committee. Well, it's currently legal.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, it's on the DHS website on their lead prevention program.
My other follow-up, I do have another one if you'll allow it, Mr. Chair.
Certainly, I'd love to hear your next question.
Thank you. Mr. Shull, if we didn't get through this in this session, and strangely all came to our senses and went home, and we didn't have a law like this, there is a mechanism. You talked about clarifying, focus, and testing that may come out of this bill. But if we didn't have this, is there a mechanism for a parent whose child has been injured by a toy and they believe it's the negligence of the maker and the retailer? Is there a mechanism currently for them to sue or to find some kind of remedy to their situation?
Chair Holby, Representative Gilliam. The short answer to that, I believe, is yes. If you have a child who is injured by a product, particularly a product that's been recalled, there are common law rights and tort actions and whatnot that they can pursue against various parties involved, depending on the facts. I would like to note, if you will, that The concern here is that I can tell you, I referenced earlier that anecdotally we hear and we believe that most retailers make an effort, if not a valiant effort, to get these goods off their shelves. But with that being said, we know it does happen, that these items that have been recalled, and they've been recalled because they have a propensity to cause serious injury or worse to a child, are still on shelves. So to sort of bring that full circle, the hope of this bill, as I understand it, is to close the loop and not allow that child or help to reduce the possibility of that child getting injured and the family's recourse being through tort actions or whatever other authority may be available to them in the circuit courts.
Thank you for that, Mr. Shull. I think that was pretty well said. I think that, irregardless of whether they have an ability to take a tort action for harm, the idea of this bill being able to prevent that harm from happening may even reduce the amount of tort cases and keep kids from getting hurt or potentially dying. And so I think that a tort action doesn't cover somebody's life or the quality time or depending on their injuries, the quality of their life going forward. So although tort actions are probably great for some things, I think this bill really cuts to the heart of trying to get these things off the shelf and preventing this from happening in the first place. So, further questions of Mr. Shull. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much. Mr. Shull, I am a bit frustrated by all of this because, once again, children don't have a voice. Who's looking after the children? And in this, it appears to me there's not a strike one, two, three, and you're out. You're out of business. The only thing this says is that in an egregious case, that the Attorney General could leverage a fine. What's the fine? What is an egregious case? And I'm just seeing, I'm concerned that we're passing a bill that doesn't mean anything, really. It's a warning. And I want to be sure that the way the retailers hear about this, that every one of them, some of them may not even have computers, but they all have, a responsibility in a way, whether once a month on the first of the month to check some document that's supposed to come in the mail or on the computer. We have nothing saying you need to do this. And if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen. Does it take 3 kids or 500 kids to make it an egregious case? Excuse me, Mr. Chair, for asking more than one question.
Chair Holby, okay. Representative Nelson, and I'll try to answer all of those. I think in some one, I'm sorry if I misused the word egregious. As was the previous discussion, we use a lot of criteria to determine whether the state, whether the Attorney General is going to take an action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. So I didn't mean to, and I don't intend to mislead anyone there. One child getting hurt may, in fact, justify action by the Attorney General.
Absolutely.
So if you're at the dais and your phone happens to be on, it causes that feedback. So let's all make sure our phones are off.
Good idea, Chair Holby.
I believe, Mr. Chair, we've heard
that. That was my calling you.
BlackBerry interference.
Oh, that's BlackBerry. It wasn't me, but I'll turn mine off anyway.
So, Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, again, there could be justification for Attorney General action, for state action, in the case of simply one item being purchased and one item being injured. It would simply depend on all the other factors and all the other criteria. Also, I would point out that the bill does actually have a provision in it that essentially mandates that the retailers now have that duty to get the notices from the Consumer Safety Product Commission, whether it be by email or toll-free telephone number or otherwise. So there is a duty now imposed by that.
And if they don't, what happens? This is my question, Mr. Chair.
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, if they don't and the matter otherwise meets the criteria, the State of Oregon, the Attorney General, would take appropriate action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, as mandated by statute, unless there's a public safety or health risk, which in this case there may be, but presuming for our purposes that there isn't, the statute mandates that we essentially reach out to that store. And it's called a Notice of Unlawful Trade Practices Act Violations, and we essentially say, our evidence shows that you're violating this provision. We would like to have the conversation with you about how to solve that problem and prevent future violations of this proposed law. That's usually done in assurance of voluntary compliance. Assurance of voluntary compliance admits no wrongdoing, but sets forth mandates for conduct going forward. Also, they include any consumer restitution that may be available. In the instance of this bill, we may in fact ask that they take these products back from consumers they sold them to. And in fact, we probably would ask that they take these products back and dispose of them as properly mandated by the recall, and give the consumers the appropriate refund for that product. There may also be payments to the state.
So, Mr. Chair, could I please follow up and clarify? See, that's my concern. How do you know who's got these? You know, if you require the retailer to, you know, bring them in, now is it a new procedure? So every time I sell Mr. Gillum's
Tinkerbell lamp.
Favorite toy turtle is, if I sell that, am I supposed to keep a dang record of every person or address so that in the event it's bad, I can recall them?
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson.
My goodness.
No, I mean.
How do you know where they are?
Yeah, that's sort of a separate issue, and unfortunately, that's true with lots of goods sold, particularly goods that are sold prior to recall. You know, in today's day and age, luckily, a lot of those records exist, and press and other avenues are utilized to encourage consumers to bring those products in. But the short answer to your question is absolutely. There will probably be instances where an item has gone out, whether it was before or after a recall, and you may not be able to track who it was that purchased it.
to add.
Thank you. It's all the better reason to keep them off the shelves to start with.
Begin with, that's right.
So any other questions of Mr. Scholl? Representative Gilliam, you've been thinking hard down there. You have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not an expert, obviously, on this term constructive knowledge, and we have great legal minds on our panel here, so I don't know the case law. But I think Representative Nelson's right. The children don't have someone to speak for them, so there's a responsibility of the parents, certainly a responsibility on part of the retailer, and certainly the manufacturer. But it seems to me that invoking presumed to have actual or constructive knowledge on the part of the retailer, in addition to their responsibility and the information available to them now, is over and above putting the onus on the retailer. I'm wondering what your opinion is of that in terms of the whole continuum of who is responsible for this.
Chair Holby, Representative Gilliam, first and foremost, it is presumed. It is a presumption. And so it's something that again, as we discussed earlier, the defendant could set forth evidence and facts to overcome that presumption. But I think the short answer from us, particularly at the staff level, would again go back to the fact that the data on recalls is out there and available. There are several avenues where you can get it. If your vocation is selling these items, in particular these children's products, there needs to be some sort of effort on the part of the retailer to comply with that. There's no doubt there. They're going to have to make an effort to comply with it. Again, at least at the staff level, our argument would be, since what we're looking at is products that have the propensity to cause injury to children or worse, that's sort of an additional burden put on them by the statute that's very reasonable.
Thank you.
Further questions of Mr. Scholl?
I have one.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you very much, good Mr. Chair. Good Mr. Scholl. If it weren't for the Statesman and the Oregonian, how are these people going to know that this is a new requirement? I worry about this all the time. How do people know, that there's a new rule or regulation? Do you send something out every time, when somebody pays their, their corporate fee every year for their company?
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, no. We do have public education campaigns, and that includes not only information for consumers, but information for businesses. There are particular industries that we work very closely with regarding rules and regulations. Here, we would rely some on media, some on those sorts of avenues like the Statesman Journal and the Oregonian. We would also hope and anticipate that the various retailers, associations, and lobbyist groups and interest groups would also, who are involved in this bill, would also be on top of notifying their members. That's something that is typically an issue with new laws, but I can tell you just from experience, I very seldom have a conversation with a business that says, we didn't know that was the law.
Thank you. I want to try to keep this moving along. Mr. Scholl, thank you for your exhaustive testimony. Probably you're more exhausted than we are, but I appreciate your insights into the intricacies of this bill. And we will take your comments into great consideration.
Thank you.
For the record, it appears we have testimony that was handed in by the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association that's been distributed. I don't know if anybody wants to testify. Kristen Leonard, did you want to testify or just handing this in?
Well, do they go by?
Sure. Right. Well, she's seen them.
Yeah.
Okay. Brought you up, you know, I noticed your testimony is talking about an amendment that we haven't actually talked about yet. So, and I know you're off, you're off to another meeting, I was told, or something. So, we're going to be talking about those amendments later. So, I don't know if it's appropriate to really testify about the amendments so much, but, you know. We have your testimony.
Okay. So. Chair Holfe, members of the committee, we wanted to get written testimony to you. I'm Kristen Leonard on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and we just wanted to let the committee know how important we felt like the private right of action was to keep in the bill as it was originally drafted. I will come back by to see if this committee is still in the process of discussing this. Once the amendments have been put on the table, but we very much wanted to express our interest and appreciation in any consideration of keeping this language as it currently stands in the bill.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And Jim, in the interest, do we want to bring Andrew back up to speak to these amendments? I'm not sure if he's aware of all of them.
Any questions of the witness?
I think there'll be another opportunity for that.
Mr. Chair, I should point out that we do have, the committee members have copies of the dash 1, dash 2, and dash 3 amendments. The dash 1 amendment adds specific citation of the Department of Human Services Declaration of Authority. The dash 2 amendment makes violation an unlawful trade practice not subject to the, it's an unlawful practice not subject to the UTPA. And the dash 3 amendment prohibits private right of action unless the court has issued a UTPA permanent injunction. We have copies of those. We'll set those out here in the next minute.
So
are we supposed to already have them? I don't have one of them.
Sorry.
It's very strange.
Mr. Scholl, do you want to speak to any of these amendments, or are these something that you're not aware of?
Elysio took it.
Can I take your amendment?
Chair Hall, the members of the committee, Andrew Scholl again, Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud, Consumer Protection Section. I can just tell you quickly that the dash one amendments, that is a technical fix, as I understand it, from legislative counsel, so I won't speak to that. I can tell you that we have serious concerns about the dash three amendments, and I can expand on that at the time you all feel necessary. The dash two amendments is a proposal to put enforcement of this, retain it within the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, but to put it in 646-607. 646-607 allows for attorney general and district attorney action, so actions by the state. It does not provide a private right of action.
That was the dash two.
Correct, that's the dash two.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, did we take that out originally?
No,
we did.
No.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Just real brief overview of those amendments, because it is the intent that we discuss the three amendments before us as well. And I know we all haven't had a tremendous amount of time to look at these. They just came out this morning, and so you know I'm aware of that. So at this time, I'd like to bring up Harlan Levy. Good afternoon, Mr. Levy.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, here representing the National Federation of Independent Business. We are the nation's leading advocacy group for small business with offices in all 50 state capitals and in Washington, D.C. In Oregon, we have approximately 7,500 members. I'm here today to let you know that we share the committee's concerns about these products, especially recall products that are designed for children. However, we do have concerns with this bill that is before you. And chief among those concerns is the private cause of action. What this bill would do is it would create a new category of an unlawful trade practice. The category would be having these items for sale. Now, I stress that because you're not talking about actually selling it or putting it in the hands of the consumer. Just having it on the shelf would be a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practice Act under this bill. And then in Section 4 of the bill, you alluded to it earlier, you have what is called constructive knowledge. And the gentleman from the DOJ said, well, that's just a presumption that can be rebutted. Well, you're asking somebody to prove a negative. And you have a presumption that they have constructive knowledge, so in every time they're going to have to prove a negative that they didn't, which in many ways creates a strict liability regime where you have an assumption that just by virtue of having one of these items on the shelf, you have now violated the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which could subject you to the Department of Justice, as well as this private cause of action, which I want to note does include a right to attorney's fees. So, how does that play with my members? Remember, my members are the small ma-and-pa retailers, the not-so-sophisticated grocery chains, the people that may have one business that's been in operation for 30 or 40 years. Many of my members don't have access to the Internet. The way that I communicate with them is via fax machine, phone calls, and regular snail mail. So a lot of my folks don't have the ability to just go online and review this list. That being said, this bill would be creating a regime where you would have a situation where someone could make a completely honest mistake, place one of these items on their shelf for sale, and then end up getting sued, lose the lawsuit because of the strict liability, the constructive knowledge standard that we've talked about, and basically get put out of business because the amount of damage is not going to be the damage caused because, again, we're talking about just having it on your shelf. What we're talking about is the right to attorney's fees. I appreciate Chair Holby's willingness to look at some of these issues, and I have looked at the amendments, the Dash 3s in particular are a step in the right direction. However, we are still concerned about having this private cause of action in the bill, and we are definitely concerned about the constructive knowledge standard imposed in this bill. In conclusion, I understand what the intent of this bill is, and it's a good intent. You want to keep these items out of the hands of children. They've been recalled. They're defective. They should not be in the stream of commerce. However, the intent of this bill is not to put small ma-and-pa businesses out of business, which could very well end up happening here. The law of unintended consequences is what we're talking about. So with that, I'd be happy to conclude my testimony and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. Questions from the committee? Mr. Levy? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on what I'd asked earlier, do you have any more information about Oregon that you could shed on this in terms of how many recalls, how many serious situations, how many of these child-related products have come up in Oregon in the recent past?
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, I do not have that information, but I'd be happy to try to find it for you, bring to this committee's attention.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Glezio.
Mr. Levy, we were noting that you got out of real estate at the right time.
Chair Holvey, Representative Glezio, buy low and sell high.
That's right. Would a consumer have a reasonable expectation that a shop owner would have knowledge of whether that a product that this shop owner was selling was potentially very dangerous and harmful to children? Is that a reasonable expectation that, you know, a parent who sends their kid down to the store, that the shop owner would have some knowledge of what it is that they've got for sale? Do you think that's a reasonable expectation?
Chair Holvey, Representative Glezio, I do think it's reasonable. Let's face it, I mean, selling products that are going to cause harm and death to children is not a good business practice. Stores that do this sort of thing are not going to remain in business for very long, regardless of whether or not they get sued. Nobody's going to go there to buy anything. So it is a reasonable expectation that that be the case. What I'm worried about is the honest mistake, the situation where you have a recall and you've got goods on a shelf already and they don't know. And in that situation, this statute, this bill, will create strict liability where someone could file a lawsuit and get their attorney's fees paid, and basically it's a gotcha situation. That's what we're worried about.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson.
Harlan, real estate's included in this bill. Just thought I'd let you know. Whether or not you're involved, I thought that was why you were still here. But there's already a law on this. Are you aware of that?
Chair Hovey, Representative Nelson, I'm aware of the federal recall law. Sure. Is that what you're getting at?
No, I'm talking about 453.055 that talks about hazardous, banned hazardous, misbranded hazardous substances, declaration removal from commerce, that sort of thing. It talks about the Director of Human Services, you know, declaring these things. And it seems like all we need to do is to, you know, make businesses aware. I mean, for example, in the slide, it says, you know, if a director finds that any hazardous substance is misbranded hazardous substance, he shall require reasonable variations or labeling requirements, for example. So that's one protection. I mean, if you label, you know, it's just like every time you get plastic bags, they say do not leave for children. And another one, if you get pillowcases, it says, you know, there's a warning, this material's not good for you. Okay. Then the next one says that if the director of DHS finds that a toy or another article intended for use by children is hazardous, blah, blah, the director shall declare a toy or other article to be a banned hazardous substance and require its removal from commerce. I guess I'm just a bit concerned here in our own state. We're requiring, I mean, we already have this. We either need to remove 453 and change it to the law we're making now, or vice versa, because this clearly identifies already that any materials your businessmen can be selling. The only difference is you probably don't have the DHS director walking in your store to audit it every other day. Are there any audits of your businesses to see if you've got hazardous stuff on the shelf?
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, I don't know of any audits.
Yeah, I don't know either.
But our position here is not that we oppose the idea of the recall or oppose the idea of getting the things off of the shelves. The problem is the enforcement mechanism in this bill, the private cause of action that would theoretically put a small business at risk of a lawsuit that they would not be able to litigate, and if they were to lose, that they would not be able to survive the final judgment because of the attorney fees provision. Now, I've talked with the chair about some kind of alternative to this, and I think it's reasonable that there be some kind of administrative action under the Administrative Procedures Act where a state agency would have authority, like in any other APA action, to bring a potential violator into a contested case where they would have due process rights, and it would be a contested case hearing under the Administrative Procedures Act where they would be able to state their case, defend themselves, and the administrator would have the burden of proving that they were guilty. I mean, the presumption here shouldn't be constructive knowledge, shouldn't be guilt. The presumption should be innocence. I mean, proof beyond a reasonable doubt is the criminal standard. In a civil case, the burden still remains on the plaintiff to prove beyond a preponderance that their side is the correct side. So we're worried about the private cause of action. We're worried about the presumption here. And we can accomplish the same means that this bill wants to accomplish without going down this strict liability road.
Mr. Chair, can I just give a quick follow-up?
Real yeah, please. We do have a very limited amount of time, and we have much more to get through.
Thank you. Very limited. I just want to bring attention to 646.638, where it already says that an individual may bring an individual action in appropriate court to recover actual damages or $200, whichever is greater, and the court can award punitive damages, and the court may provide the equitable relief the court considers necessary or proper. So I guess Mr. Shaw would have to explain this from legalese, you know, because it appears to me that we already have the documents.
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, what you're looking at is the Unlawful Trade Practice Act. And my understanding of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act is it's designed to address the problem in common law fraud. Fraud is very difficult to prove under the common law. So the Unlawful Trade Practices Act was codified to give plaintiffs an easier chance of proving fraud. But when you have fraud, what you have is a bad actor. You have somebody that's intending to commit fraud, to defraud somebody else. What this bill does is it takes a completely innocent mistake, something that is not fraud, something where somebody just made a mistake, and now equating it to the level of fraud. And that is where we object to what this bill is trying to do.
Okay. Thank you. That was a good answer.
So, Mr. Levy, so going back just a couple steps to your issue about the private cause for action, how would someone who's been harmed, a child that's, you know, ended up, perhaps crippled for life, how would they recover any damages without the private cause of action?
Chair Holby, they would have a tort action. They would have the common law tort action, and trial lawyers file those cases every day of the week. They would have a remedy there. What we are worried about in this bill is now you're creating a remedy where there is no harm, where the thing is merely on the shelf, and now you've got strict liability for violating the Unlawful Trade Practice Act, which could result in attorney's fees. So if we want to get the things off the shelf, which is my understanding of the intent of this bill, it's not to put people out of business, it's not to have people win big attorney's fees judgments, it's to get the stuff off the shelf. The way you get it off the shelf is you set up an administrative hearing process where someone is brought before an administrative law judge, an impartial judge, who then would make a determination that what you have here is something that's prohibited, get it off the shelf. And if I presume there'd be progressive discipline in there. So if this person is there a second time, they would get dinged for a pretty severe penalty. That's fine. That is the type of administrative proceeding that we think would accomplish the means that this committee is looking to accomplish.
Thank you. Question, Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to make this quick. My first point is more of a comment than a question. You keep talking about the possibility of attorney's fees, but those are only for the prevailing party, correct? So a company would not be required to pay attorney's fees unless they lost the case. Right.
Chair Holby, Representative Bonamici, yes, but they were still going to have to pay their own attorney to defend them. And in many cases, for a small business, that's all it takes to put them over the edge.
Understood. But my main question has to do with the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, as you know, is quite a long list of existing prohibitions that many of them already apply to your members because they have to do with selling goods and services and misrepresentations about goods and services and advertising goods. So there's already many, many things on here. Gosh, maybe one of your members is selling an old mercury thermometer, for example. My point is that aren't there already a lot of requirements that your members have to comply with under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act? And if I understand that this is one more, but it isn't the only, it isn't a big new burden because there are already many things that they need to comply with under the existing statute.
Chair Holby, Representative Bonamici, I think the key phrase there was misrepresentations. Everything else on this laundry list is a misrepresentation where you have somebody with the intent to commit fraud against somebody else. What this bill contemplates doing is taking an honest mistake where something, for whatever reason, did not get pulled off of a shelf and making that the same level as a misrepresentation. And that's where we have a problem.
And just to follow very briefly on a point that Representative Galizio made, I believe, is that I believe it could very easily be construed as a representation if something is on a shelf that it is safe for consumption. So I would submit that it could be construed as a misrepresentation to have something on the shelf that's not safe, that's been recalled. So it's a comment rather than a question.
Further questions, Mr. Levy? Thank you for your testimony and your insight from the perspective of the NFIB. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Hall.
Next up, I have Betsy Earls.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. If you could identify yourself for the committee, please.
Okay. For the record, I'm Betsy Earls, and I am representing the AOI Retail Council on House Bill 3631. Just to start out, I'd like to make sure that you understand that the AOI Retail Council and all its members are very fully committed to ensuring the safety of Oregon's children and managing the products that they sell to the best of their abilities. And we have no argument at all with the basic premise of this bill. However, we do have some of the same concerns that were articulated by Mr. Levy from NFIB, and we have appreciated the opportunity to try and work some of those out with you, Mr. Chair, and with other members of the committee to the extent possible. Oregon retailers do have a number of ways to find out that products have been recalled, but the bill allows absolutely no space for an honest mistake by a retailer or the possibility of a rogue employee, which amounts to the same thing as an honest mistake by an Oregon retailer. And we would hate to see some kind of strict liability scheme such as is contemplated by putting this requirement under the Unfair Trade Practices Act. There is already a remedy for common law negligence that's available to plaintiffs who have suffered serious harm. And I understand that there's a large gap between doing nothing on the retailer's part all the way over to a negligence action. That's a pretty big space to have to go for an injured member of the public. But we think that that gap is probably not best filled by placing a remedy under the Unfair Trade Practices Act with the concurrent private right of action. We see a better remedy being an administrative action such as that which is contemplated by part of the Unfair Trade Practices Act or which may be placed in some other agency, perhaps DCBS. So with that, we would appreciate a chance to work a little bit further on the amendments, and we are fully committed to working out a solution to this issue that's acceptable to everybody here.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Belizio.
Yeah, Mr. Rolls, I'm trying to understand. I think I understand your argument, but if my business is selling goods, one would assume and one would hope, and it would be the responsibility of that person selling goods to know a bit about the goods and not just throwing them on the shelf. And I mean, I keep hearing honest mistake. I mean, what does the shopkeeper have no responsibility to know about what it is that they're selling and whether or not it's been recalled because it's a dangerous product? I mean, how does that constitute an honest mistake?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Galizio, I think there's an awful lot of space between taking good care to put products on your shelves that are safe and throwing them up there and having absolutely no responsibility. I think that all of our retailers take very seriously their responsibility to the public over and above any law that may or may not require them to remove recalled products from their shelves. Their most important responsibility, and I know they see it this way, is to make sure that the public is safe from potential harm from products that they sell. So I don't think that I think there is a great deal of difference between an honest mistake and no responsibility at all on the part of the retailer. I think that even though they take that responsibility very seriously, there is such a thing as an honest mistake where they tried very hard and they missed it. Or they didn't know for one day and that one day something was purchased.
Representative Gilliam, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I just noticed that the Vice Chair had a question. I'd yield to her if that's all right with you.
Oh. Representative Nelson, you've been yielded to.
I know. I think ever since Representative Gilliam moved on that side. You look over there first.
Well, I'm used to having you over here. And
okay.
So,
thank you, Dad. That's so good enough for me.
Yeah, take a little training here.
Ms. Earls, I know how bright you are. So.
Plus, I have to keep an eye on him a lot more.
So. Oh, I see. Okay. I'm proud of you. Can you tell me, are there any other states I'm sure you've already researched it, that have this law? Or maybe Mr. Scholl has to answer it.
Well, I know Mr. Scholl knows because he and I have talked about it, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. But
did he come up and answer that question?
Different states have approached this in different ways.
What else have they done?
Oh, I think maybe we should call Mr. Scholl.
Okay.
Why not?
She's running the meeting.
Chair Holder, Representative Nelson, for the actual specifics, we've compiled some information, and so I will email that to you. But as Ms. Earls was alluding to, many states have taken different avenues to essentially come to the same conclusion. But what a lot of states have done have created their own lists. And through their version of what we would consider DHS, for example, they've created their own list of what's considered a dangerous children's product, and they've made this list available. Again, like the Consumer Safety Products Commission through the internet and through email, and then the end result has been if you're selling that product that shows on that list, you've violated their statute. Ms. Earls may be able to talk more in terms of private rights of action in those other states. I don't know. I know those other states sometimes have administrative, sometimes have attorney general enforcement. I don't know how many of those states, if any, have a private right of action.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you, just kind of following up on Representative Galizio's thought, there is a responsibility on the part of retailers and folks that are in your association. And I have a great deal of confidence in retailers in Oregon that they're trying to do the right thing and they are responsible. But to improve that situation, do you have any ideas or mechanisms in place to help retailers from a private standpoint to connect to the information that's been outlined here? In other words, if there are lists and email lists and other things that they may not know about or have a computer to connect to in the case of a mom and pop, are there ways that your association could help them connect to that and be more responsible retailers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilliam, I think in the instance of retailers that do have access to the Internet, certainly we have several ways of reaching them, and we'll have actually talked with the Attorney General's office already about starting an effort like that if something comes up. As far as retailers that don't have access to the Internet, we have several mailings that go out every month that we would be happy to work with the Attorney General's office to provide information if that seemed like the best way to handle the outreach.
Further questions of the two that are sitting before us at this point?
Other than I'll be glad to get, I hope we can all get a copy of the states and what they do, other states. Thank you.
So I have one more before you get down. I just, coming back to this responsibility to the retailer and the honest mistake, you know, point of view. Clearly, the Department of Justice in an Unlawful Trade Practice Act has the ability to look at a case and determine whether it was an honest mistake, and I think they're, you know, I can't speak to personal knowledge, but I've been told that, you know, they're usually pretty reasonable about addressing those issues, you know, appropriately. And the other part of this is that, you know, frankly, I guess the point is these are recalled products. It's not against the law to put them on the shelves. And many retailers have recalled products on their shelves. And, you know, the point of this is to get them off the shelves so they don't end up in the hands of the consumer where they can cause damage and create more litigation and more importantly, hurt somebody. And so I think that's the tussle we're having, and clearly we don't want to end up punishing an honest mistake, but if you're in the business of selling products, you ought to be aware of the products you're selling and whether they're on the recall list or not, and then at that point you make a choice of whether or not you're going to put it on the shelf or not. And I think this bill's aimed at addressing that situation and trying to keep these products off the shelf to start with, because it hasn't worked so far of keeping them off the shelf. Has been evidenced, and KGW News did a TV story on it, and I've seen it in newspapers around the state, and clearly I think there is an issue out there, and as we've seen more and more products coming from overseas that are clearly dangerous, this has become an epidemic problem that I think the state really has an obligation to get out in front of, and I think very quickly. And I know there's been some discussion about the hazardous materials. That's a different section of law that really has nothing to do with recalled products. That's a different way to address a similar situation that DHS has the statutory authority to do, but really has no, I don't believe, any funding to exercise that kind of a program at this point. So, just a caveat to that. But this bill is really aimed at a different classification, and that is the recalled product, and because many of these products are on the recalled list, maybe not all of the hazardous material products that are referred to in the other statute would be on the recall list, and vice versa. So they're really different mechanisms to address a similar problem, but not necessarily the same problem. So with that little thing, I guess I'm going to excuse you. Just for about 10 more minutes is all. That's fine. And next up, I'd like to bring Sean Miller. Mr. Miller, go ahead and identify yourself. I already have, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name's Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in opposition to House Bill 3631 as drafted. And like Mr. Levy, Mrs. Earls, the concept and the responsibility that we as retailers have, we take this recalls very seriously. We are familiar in many cases with food recalls in our industry. However, we do sell the products, children's products as defined under Section 1 in most of our stores. Our member companies range from the large chain companies down to the very small independent or C stores. And we have 220 member companies with about 800 locations throughout the state. Our concern, and I won't reiterate this a lot that's been testified, but it is a lot with the presumption in Section 4 that we're presumed to have this actual constructive knowledge of the recall. And, in some of our stores, we have compliance officers who may check that website 3 days, three times a day, call the toll-free number, and believe me, they have systems set up to make sure that they're in compliance. Some of our smaller stores, it may be difficult to, in the middle of a day in a very small store in rural Oregon, be able to jump on the internet and check that every single day, or make sure that the toll-free number and the things that were listed and what you've heard are actually done. I know that it was referenced under the Unfair Trade Practices Act, this willful standard, where you knew or should have known. And again, our concern of the bill and talking about this honest mistake, first responsibility, we rely on our manufacturers to provide us a product that's safe. And so if, for instance, the product is not safe, does cause damage, you've heard that there is an existing essentially tort action that you can, if the go after the manufacturer or at least have avenues to adjudicate those instances. In what our concern with this particular bill, again, is this willful standard that puts us in a situation in court defending ourselves that we either knew or should have known. And in many cases, in some cases, the honest mistake could happen because the recall could be issued and a product could be sold that day. Later that day, they did find out that there was a recall notice. Well, they go to the shelves, they remove those items, because that's the responsibility of our retailers. If we know that there's a notice out there, we're going to remove those products immediately. And so in that instance, it's not, and I heard some of the responsibility issues with the Attorney General, and there may be a reasonableness to decide that, but when you have a private right of action, there is no reasonableness, or at least in the case, all you have to do is have a lawyer that wants to bring a case before you and sue you. And in that instance, we are then thrust into the court system defending ourselves, whether we knew or should have known, should you have checked that website 5 times a day and made sure that you, the second that thing was issued, that the stuff was off the shelf. Now, that is the honest mistake that I think we're concerned with. You know, the willful retailer that knows of a recalled item and decides to sell that product, believe me, we are completely supportive of making sure that person is punished. However, the way this is written, and without a process that at least gives us some form of due process and understanding of how that would take place, we have problems with that language in Section 4. I know there were some questions on, how can we make this better? How can we communicate better? Well, I think in Section 3, where the Attorney General does want to provide some form of better communication, figuring out ways with the retail community like ours and others. Believe me, we are all in support of making sure that that information is out to the public. But the bill as drafted does provide some concerns to our members, and we're more than willing to work with the committee to try to improve the bill. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. I think I'm going to dispense with the questions on your behalf.
Dispense me.
appreciate you coming forward and offering your testimony, and we'll have another opportunity to talk. With that, I know there's no one left on the list that wishes or that has signed up to speak. I do have a note from someone else, and I didn't know if anyone from DHS wished to comment. They're not necessary on some of the things that have been said about the other statute, we'll say. So they're welcome to do that if they wish, if they think that there's something they need to say. If not, then I have one more person that signed up, Matt Wallace.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Matt Wallace. I'm the consumer associate for Osberg, for the record. And I am here today to testify on behalf of Osberg in favor of House Bill 3631 as a step forward in protecting children from unsafe products. I'll keep my spoken testimony short and perhaps just address very briefly some of the questions that I think have come up. But I think it is, of course, worth noting that this issue, of course, doesn't exist. It isn't coming forward, in a vacuum. 2007 was, as we all know, the year of the recall. And in response, I think, to a question asked by Representative Gilliam earlier, what is the extent of this problem in Oregon? While there have been over 4,000 products recalled over the history of the CPSC, hundreds last year, those products, of course, represent millions of individual toys. So for each brand or each instance of a product. So, in fact, just over 2007, more than actual 25 million individual toys were recalled because of safety concerns. And while I don't have any specific data for the actual numbers of toys or products that were sold in Oregon, the more common a toy nationally, I think it's safe to say the more likely there were a number of instances here in Oregon that were affected by the recall. One of the interesting things about the recent wave of recalls is the number of products that are Again, you know, just nationally distributed, very popular brand name products such as, you know, Toys in the Barbie line, Thomas the Tank Engine, a lot of these other products that were subject to recalls because of, in many cases, toxic lead paint, which is a special concern to Osprey, as well as other hazards such as choking and well, a whole range of issues. Again, we haven't actually had a chance to. I haven't actually had a chance to take a look at the amendments that have been offered. What I will say is that you know, this bill, as proposed, would close a loophole that currently exists in protecting children from unsafe toys and unsafe products. It's a small step in an issue that there are many possible steps, but one thing that should be done is just making sure that we have a way to enforce that toys that have already been recalled have been already found to be dangerous to present dangers to children. You know, are not being sold, and that is the exact loophole that we feel 3631 effectively addresses, and why we think it should be moved forward. And then the only other thing I would speak to is of course, that enforcement is, you know, a very key issue in any bill like this. Well, I haven't, again, had a chance to take a look at the amendments yet since these were distributed, but we need to, any bill that passes, we need to make sure that there is a substantial ability for consumers and for the state to make sure that the law is being followed and that the loophole stays closed effectively. With that, I'll go ahead and conclude my comments.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wallace, for your testimony, and I know for your concern for kids. I just want to underline again, and Mr. Chair, you alluded to this in your speech, it's always important to understand what's happening, you know, nationally, internationally. I absolutely concur there must be millions of toys. I'm still interested because our job here is not to fix it in China or to fix it in Idaho. It's all interesting. Our job is Oregon. And I still think, for a context, you're not charged with this, but I am eager to find numbers about Oregon, because we hear words like epidemic on one hand. You said a number of instances. I believe both of you. But your imprecision reminds me of a floor speech that I might give. So I'm just eager if we can get to that number. It'd be very helpful.
Thank you, but I think you should hold your personal opinions of people to yourself. But hopefully he doesn't take offense to that.
I promise I don't.
And, okay.
Chair Holder, should.
Chair Holder, Representative Gilliam, I'd be happy to see what I can, you know, dig up for specific numbers on that. Although, you know, again, I haven't seen data like that for broken down for Oregon for specific numbers.
Thank you very much. I'm going to have to cut you off right here, right now, and appreciate your testimony. We've got your written testimony, and thank you very much for your testimony. With that, committee, I am going to carry this bill forward to tomorrow, which is February 6th at 1 o'clock, same room, I believe. And so we will continue this conversation and try to hammer out the details to get this bill moving forward. So thank you very much for your attention. Thank you for all those that testified. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 30.